This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. As I scrolled through my social media feeds on election night, a common theme emerged from my friends' shocked reflections. How could there be so many racist, sexist, misogynist, anti-immigrant, homophobic Americans in the country that they were able to elect Donald Trump? For people of color, for oppressed minorities especially, the next 4 years will be terrifying if Trump keeps his promises to ban all Muslims, build a wall on the border, gut Planned Parenthood, and much more. How can we survive this? My guest is Courtney Morris. She's an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University and a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. Welcome to the program, Courtney.
Hi, Sonali.
Can you first begin by your reflections on the issue of the election, on the result? It felt to me, as I was watching it, that not only did this upend all expectations, I felt a personal sense of fear.
I think for many of us, I'm as much of a political animal as anybody else. And so I was following the news compulsively in the weeks leading up to the election. And I think that for many of us, the idea of Donald Trump winning just seemed inconceivable. Even as we may have witnessed growing support for him around the country. So I just think about the number of times that I would drive. I live in rural Pennsylvania. I teach at Penn State. And I saw the number of Trump signs in my neighborhood growing. I would see them along the highway. I saw them in rural upstate New York. And I think that while there was a sense that it seemed logical that there would be support for him in rural areas, I think people were not prepared for how widespread the support for Donald Trump became by the time we arrived to Election Day. And so the feeling last night was one of just kind of shock and disbelief as I followed the results coming in. I was, checking Facebook and seeing how people were responding. And the general sense was this cannot be happening. Very much like it was America having its very own Brexit sort of moment. And indeed, it did happen. And so, I think that it's really forcing a lot of us to reevaluate whatever assumptions we may have had about the kinds of political shifts that were happening among the American electorate, and realizing that these challenges of racism and misogyny and homophobia and just general white resentment are much more entrenched than had been previously imagined. And that when white voters imagine themselves threatened by the political demands of people of color, of immigrants, of women, they are able to reconsolidate as a political bloc to protect their group interests. And so it's a very shocking and disheartening moment, I think, for many of us in progressive circles.
And Hillary Clinton lost Pennsylvania by a thread. I mean, this was a big upset. And I'm wondering if you think it's not enough people came out to support her, or that Trump was able to rally many more than people expected, many more supporters, particularly from rural areas like where you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think it was a combination of factors. I mean, it's certainly it's no secret that there were a number of people who are Democrats who were really disaffected by what had taken place during the primaries and the kind of displacement of Bernie Sanders as a potential candidate as a potential nominee for the Democratic Party. So I think there were a number of people who, had Bernie Sanders been the candidate, might have come out in stronger numbers, who simply opted to stay home and not to participate in the process. So that's certainly part of the issue. But even if those people had come out, again, I think much of the narrative that we saw in the months leading up to the election was this idea that Donald Trump's base of support was really only disaffected rural white voters. But the numbers just don't bear that out. In fact, what we found, there's a report that was produced by The Guardian today, where it was saying that across the board, whites, regardless of men and women, regardless of levels of education, regardless of levels of income, regardless of geographical location, whether they were urban or rural voters, across the board, white voters voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, right?
Except, I think, educated white women were the one group he didn't win.
No, he did win educated white women. And in fact, educated white women, slightly less than half of educated white women voted for him. 45% voted for Donald Trump. So even in light of the recent revelations around him being a number of women accusing him of sexually assaulting them, the very explicitly misogynist rhetoric, his abysmal treatment of female political figures, that was not enough to galvanize support for Hillary. So I think that in the end, it was a combination of factors in terms of Hillary's deep unpopularity as a candidate, but also, again, I think that political analysts did not realize that this politics of white resentment is not just limited to the white working class, but it is a broader political phenomenon that we need to contend with.
Right. And I'm wondering, you know, that sentiment by the University of Texas student who didn't get a place on the university rolls and so sued, claiming that affirmative action hurt her. This is an educated woman. This is the sort of thing that, you know, I'm wondering, it was an undercurrent, and that polls, one of the reasons polls might have missed that, and this was alluded to earlier in our coverage, is that a lot of Trump voters may have been embarrassed to admit openly that they were voting for Trump. But now here it is. We have President-elect Donald Trump. He made some very ludicrous sounding promises to his base, such as banning Muslims from the country. I don't know how he would do that. How, you know, wouldn't that be a violation of our constitution to respect religious rights, etc.? The border wall with Mexico. How is he going to keep these promises? And if he does, this is terrifying for minorities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a couple of things to consider. I mean, the fact of the matter is that most politicians are not able to keep all of the promises that they make while they're running for office. That's just kind of a fact of political life. So I think that there are going to be some things that he's not going to be able to deliver on. It was very interesting in his acceptance speech last night. He made no mention of the border wall, made no mention about excluding Muslim immigrants, didn't talk about any of the, you know, attempts to pursue legal action against Hillary Clinton and try to lock her up. None of those rhetorical moves came up in his speech. So he seemed to be, you know, putting forward a more conciliatory, seemingly more inclusive rhetoric about what his administration would look like. That said, you know, Trump is in a really enviable position. He has control of all three branches of government, the legislative branch, the judicial branch. He'll be appointing our next Supreme Court justice, and he has control of the executive branch. So really anything that he wants to do, unless Democrats are able to mobilize to block his policy initiatives, he really has carte blanche to do a lot of what he wants. So it's a kind of a frightening moment to be living in, because he does have so much popular support among white conservative white voters, and he has the structural power to do the things that he wants to do. Whether he's going to continue to try to follow through on that remains to be seen, but certainly he's in a position where if he wanted to move on those things, he could do it. He would encounter some opposition because many of the policy initiatives that he has proposed are in fact unconstitutional. But as we've seen in the past, just because something is unconstitutional doesn't mean that it can't be codified into law.
Now, Courtney, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote barely. I mean, it was 180,000 votes by which she won it. So essentially, the country seems pretty evenly split, at least if you measure it by the voting electorate. It doesn't give Trump a huge mandate. There are masses of us who feel like we are in a nightmare that we could just, you know, wish we could just wake up from, and the next day we'll have somebody like Obama, maybe Clinton, whoever, just somebody, a placeholder, but not Trump. I don't know why Trump's voters think that Trump can actually get away with doing the kinds of things to us. You know, let's just say it, to us, to you and I, and people who look and sound like us, who have names like ours and skin color like us, how Trump could get away with doing these things to us, because there are growing numbers of us. We may be in urban areas rather than rural areas, but we are here. They can't get rid of us. They can wish us away, but we're not going away.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a really, I will confess to being deeply frightened. I'm angry, I'm troubled, but I'm also afraid.
I didn't know what to tell my two brown-skinned sons this morning. I just didn't know what to tell them.
I was very grateful this morning that I don't have children, because honestly, I'd have no idea what to say to them other than, you know, the best thing that we can do is to remember that there have been struggles like this before, right? One can think about, I'm a student of history. That's what I do for a living. And I think about the historical past a lot. And I think that, you know, if we look back at, say, the era of Reconstruction, right, where Black people had managed to create a space for themselves in political society and in civil society to attain some level of political representation, to attain some level of economic self-determination, and to witness all of that shattered by the end of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow. I mean, that must have felt like the end of the world, and yet people survived that. And so I think that we have very powerful political traditions that we can draw from to help us weather this moment. And so looking back to the past is very important. But beyond that, I also think that, you know, the things that we're seeing right now, and I think Van Jones last night said it very, very eloquently, that we are living in the middle of a backlash. And part of how you know that your political movements are effective is that they produce backlash. And I think that what we've been seeing in the last few years with the rise of Black Lives Matter, these growing movements against police abuse, growing movement for climate justice, immigration reform, movements to try to end U.S. wars of aggression in the Middle East, all of those political projects have really taken on increased resonance in the public imagination. And I think that conservatives and white people in particular in this country are terrified of where they see things going. And this was a concerted effort, as I said, for white people to consolidate themselves as a political bloc to defend what they perceive to be their threat and political interest. And they're absolutely right. We are coming for their stuff. And I think that... That we are right, and they're right, and we're coming for those things because those are things that have been illegally and unjustly denied to us for too long. And so I think right now we just need to regroup, rethink our political strategy, but also recognize that a backlash means that you are hitting a nerve. You're hitting a nerve, and you just have to keep pushing and moving forward.
I think I needed to hear that, and I think that that's a really important point, Courtney, that those people who are seen as the outsiders, as those people who are seen as having taken away something that whites had, and I say whites generally speaking, obviously, a lot of white folks did vote for Hillary Clinton too, but I see, you know, I think that we have to remind ourselves these have been things that have been denied to us. If we look at the struggle over the Dakota Access Pipeline, Native Americans, the original inhabitants of this land are still fighting to simply have control over the tiny bits of parcels of land that they have barely retained some ownership over and control over. And Courtney, finally, in the last few moments of our conversation, let's talk about the fact that the Trump presidency is coming on the heels of the nation's first Black president, that history was made 8 years ago with Barack Obama, and one can, you know, assess Obama's presidency as critically as you want. But and in just a moment, I'll play a clip from his remarks after the election. But how much of Obama's modest legacy is going to be upended now?
Oh, I mean, Trump has made it very clear, and his allies have made very clear their intention to basically carry out the political project that Republicans initiated when Obama came into office, which was to block him at every turn and to thwart every policy initiative that he began. So, you know, we find ourselves facing the possibility of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which will have huge implications for poor and working class people all over the country who rely on the federal government to provide them with access to health, to quality health care. We're dealing with a president who doesn't believe in climate change, right? Who thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetuated by, you know, Chinese businessmen to get the jump on the U.S. private sector. So, you know, there are a number of areas where I think that Obama's legacy really is it really is imperiled, and the very few progressive measures that he was able to enact during his administration are in grave risk of being undone. And so, you know, part of the work is really going to have to be working to protect the gains of the Obama administration, while also keeping an eye on the kinds of new policy measures that Trump and his supporters will be pushing forward that are really going to hurt so many people across the political spectrum, not just people of color, but also many of the working class white people who put him into office. So, you know, in a way, I think that we really have a much larger responsibility, not just to defending our own communities, which is work that we've always done and will continue to do, but making sure that, you know, that we don't allow white voters to burn this village in order to save it. We have a lot of work on our hands to do.
Wow. And let's play an excerpt of President Obama's speech given on Wednesday morning, his remarks post-election.
We have to remember that we're actually all on one team. This is an intramural scrimmage. We're not Democrats first. We're not Republicans first. We are Americans first. We're patriots first. We all want what's best for this country. That's what I heard in Mr. Trump's remarks last night. That's what I heard when I spoke to him directly, and I was heartened by that. That's what the country needs, a sense of unity, a sense of inclusion, a respect for our institutions, our way of life, rule of law, and a respect for each other. I hope that he maintains that spirit throughout this transition, and I certainly hope that's how his presidency has a chance to begin.
That's President Obama speaking on Wednesday to the public after the election of Donald Trump. Well, finally, Courtney, given that we are at this very, very difficult moment, I want to go back to what you were saying about white voters protecting their own. How important is education, independent media, independent sources of information? How important is all of that as we head into this next chapter? Because it feels like we can dig our heels in and dismiss everybody as racist, or maybe we can work to try to understand the other side and try to get them to see our perspectives as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, this is something, as someone who lives in rural Pennsylvania, I do find myself thinking a lot, or today I've been reflecting a lot on, you know, what is the work that I can do in the community where I live to engage people who may have felt alienated by the last 8 years of the Obama administration. Some of that are things that I don't know that that I can speak to, but certainly I do think that there are points of common interest in terms of people's concerns about the economy, people's concerns about the military and defense and U.S. foreign policy. You know, I think that those are areas where we might be able to find some common ground. But really, I think we have to contend. You know, one of the things that I was really struck by in Van Jones's comments last night is he says, you know, when we talked about what happened with this election, we were willing to talk about everything but race. And I think that there has to be a really intentional, robust public conversation about the role that white fear and resentment play in national politics. And it's something that the Republican Party understood very well. Political strategists like Lee Atwater and Karl Rove have leveraged, you know, this is part of what is called the Southern strategy, right? That conservative politicians have relied on the sort of animus that white voters have towards blacks, towards immigrants, towards feminists, towards queer people, anybody who's perceived as other, and that this has become a kind of defining feature of the conservative political project in the modern era. And so I think that we have to grapple with that. And I'm not sure, I can't prescribe a strategy, but I think that before we can find common ground, we have to figure out ways to work with white voters to try to figure out if there's a possibility of helping them to divest from the project of whiteness so that they can then think about the political problems that are facing our country in broader terms, and to understand that they're not on one boat and the rest of us are on another boat, but we are all in the same boat together. And if they sink that ship, we're all going to go down with them. So if that's possible, I don't know if that's possible, but I think that is the work that we must do.
Well, and I think we're going to need you more than ever to remind us of that, Courtney Morris. It's always so important for us to hear your voice. We will be having you back on regularly. Thank you for everything you do.
My pleasure. Y'all take care.
Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University and a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.